Okay, so my name is Vladimir Ivanovich. I am a computer scientist sophomore. I am going to talk to you about quantum computing. Specifically, I would like to just go over the general parts of a quantum computer so you know what type of physics is involved, what you can and can't do with a quantum computer, and in general, why it's so cool. So here's my rough overview of what I'll be talking about. So the first thing I want to discuss is just what the difference is from a quantum computer to a regular computer that I have two of right here. Then I want to go over the uses of quantum computing, and I'll give you a specific example of an algorithm for searching in a database. Then I'll cover what it's usually made of, the components of a computer. Then I'll also go over the physical properties such as entanglement and wave collapsing and all that for you guys. And of course, I'll discuss some issues with quantum computing and future uses and why it's important to have research in quantum computing. I'll start here with the classic computer. So Alan Turing is a famous mathematician during World War II that developed basically the basic concept of the computer. And he had three main points for it. First was, you need to have some way to store information. You need to have some type of operations, mathematical operations, as defined by George Boole, I believe, who gave us Boolean algebra. And then you also have to be able to get that information. Well, it works just fine and dandy for regular computers, as we have zero and one states. We have bits that you know we usually see as zeros and ones. For a quantum computer, you actually have quantum bits, which are usually represented with maybe a single electron, a photon, or a positively charged ion, or maybe sometimes even a type form or current, I'll discuss. However, as we've been talking about, that there's actually a principle of superposition, basically the idea of a quantum bit taking two states of zero and one, as we just talked about the Schrodinger's cat being both alive and dead. So then you have to factor that in for a quantum computer, while for a regular computer, you don't have to worry about such things. It's only zero or one. Another difference is between logical gates. Here I actually gave the same form of gate. This over on the far right is the regular logical inverter. So from A to B, it's just not A. Here, it's similar concept in the sense that if you gave a quantum bit that represented a 1 or a 0, it would actually give you the inverse. But if you gave it a superposition of the two states, or somewhere in that, over on the far right, some point on that surface, you would actually get something different, but you would still be able to get back to your superposition state. So, I'll cover now, I kind of gave you the rough overview of differences with the computer. One of the things for the uses for the quantum computer is you can actually simulate quantum mechanical states, as in you can actually derive how a chemical reaction would occur. Over there on the far right is a picture of just waveforms of a couple quantum electrons, I assume, interacting with each other. So you could actually simulate that in the more authenticity than using pseudo-random number generators on a computer. Also, as I just looked up, Fourier wave transformations are easily done on quantum bits, as in they'll give you whatever you need from that. And then, of course, another important use is prime factorization. You can actually use a quantum computer to find the prime factors of a number with, let's say, 128 bits long. So I put in some random number with a dot, dot, dot in there. Let's just throw in 20 digits. It can get you that within a couple of seconds. A regular computer could do it, not as fast, nowhere near as fast. In fact, if we're given, let's say, a number with 128 bits, there are 2 to the 128 possible numbers that it can hold. The fastest possible formula we have for algorithm to solve in regular computing will give us a speed at about this. For a quantum computer, it can do it at log of 2 to the 128, which just goes down to 128. Now, I'm sure you can agree with me that this is much smaller than that. And then another final part that I'll just mention is that quantum searches are a lot faster than a linear search, and that's actually my next point. Okay, so there's a famous, or a guy who worked on the called Grover, I guess, is Grover's algorithm for finding an element in a large data set. So one of the first things you have to describe is that this data set is not ordered, that there is no structure that you know of, and that the best way you can do it on a conventional computer is to just go sequentially. So if you're given n inputs or n numbers, it would take you about n minus 1 to find the number, because you know you have to go through almost all of the entries. But you could also do it in a random fashion. You know, you could randomly pick them, and probability-wise, you could do it in n over 2. So that's about as fast as you can go. With the algorithm that you see here, or that I'll discuss, you can do it in the square root of n time. So if you have 1 million phone numbers, let's say, you can find the one you're looking for that matches, let's say, my name in 1,000 searches. And this is done here. I'm presented to you kind of in a visual manner. Basically, assume that T is the answer or the proper state of bits that you want to find. And you just start with your random guess at zero, or kind of like just the initial state. You can do a simple transformation to move it up here, and these four linear transformations, you actually repeat that a couple times, and you actually slowly go counterclockwise until you reach the final answer. And you can determine how many iterations you'll need to get an exact answer, but due to, I guess, the fact that there is always a probability that you might get the wrong answer, there is a 1 in 1 over n chance that it will actually be the incorrect answer. So if you have a million entries, there's a 1 in a million chance that you'll overshoot it by just a little bit. Okay. So I'm just going to quickly discuss here is what it's made of. Basically, what we need to cover for any quantum computer is it needs to be able to set all the qubits to zero or some type of initial state. It needs to be able to rotate each individual qubit through electromagnetic waves, magnetic waves, something. Then it has to be able to measure each individual qubit, and it has to perform an operation that can actually entangle the qubits together. Now, one of the ways they've done it is using ion traps, which is basically taking some positively charged ion and trapping it within a vacuum, or as they've done now, using a Bose-Einstein condensate. So basically, you take the condensate and you put one single ion in the middle of it, and it can actually supercool it to prevent it from getting excited and to, I guess, collapse away. One of the new ways that they tried is a D-wave technology, which has kind of been around in the news. They've been able to make a 16-bit register, and they're using the idea of current to represent their qubits. Basically, they have two, I guess it's called the Josephian junction. It has two semiconductors with, or two superconductors with a very thin insulator in between, so that through quantum tunneling, electrons can pass through and you can have some type of current. And basically, you just give an arbitrary one if it goes counterclockwise, or if the current goes in the loop counterclockwise, or zero if it goes clockwise. And then if it's some type of in-between state, then they kind of assume that's a quantum state. That usually, right now they're being challenged as far as how much of a quantum computer it is. There's some contentions that it's doesn't really hold up to the principles of a quantum computer. So the physical properties. One of the things is the quantum states, as long as you don't measure a qubit, you can have the superposition of random states of being between 0 and 1, or having all sorts of random angular velocities. So stuff like the, let's see, yeah, so when you have the gate up there, it's able to, as I mentioned before, to transform it to a certain position of flipping 0 to 1. And as mentioned before, it can also switch it back to a superposition of its state. And I guess I'll just say quickly move on here, that one of the important things is every time you measure a qubit, the wave collapses, as been mentioned before, to one sort of state that's already been determined. So what you have to be make sure of is that whenever you have a computer that's running its algorithm, you want to wait until the very end to measure your final qubit state, because once you measure it, it doesn't have the superposition properties that you have been using to exploit to find the answers. And as we saw, there was the 3D sphere for one qubit. For each additional qubit that can entangle with each other to fully represent all the superpositions that they can all form, you have to take a 4 to the n minus 1 representation of dimensions. So two qubits leads to a 15-dimensional representation. I put here a picture of Calabi-Yau. I think that's 11 dimensions. So picture something wackier than that. Let's see, and then I'll mention that later. Okay, so one of the issues with quantum computing is Schrodinger's cat, in the sense that through quantum decoherence, that's when outside interference collapses the wave to some certain state, either being the cat being dead or alive. And one of the issues with the quantum computers is you want to be able to complete your algorithm before quantum decoherence occurs. And that can occur with a random radiation particle hitting your ion that's trapped in the vacuum with thermal energy, or just some random, very small probabilistic chance occurring, as shown right here. A random thing just popping in there. Another issue is that there's a technology gap between the math that they have for it and the real life, I guess, circuits that they've developed. So far, they've developed a CNOT gate, which is a controlled NOT gate, and they've obviously been able to run some programs, or rudimentary programs, on 8-bit machines. But what they want to do with quantum computers, there's still a long way to go with that. And then, okay. And here, just future uses and importance. One of the things is that the quantum computer gives us a path to NP-complete problems, which is non-deterministic polynomial time problems. Basically, Turing machines, regular computers, there are certain sets of problems that it can't solve in a feasible amount of time, especially when n grows to large numbers, like a million or something. As I showed before, quantum computers can solve some of those problems using quantum, I guess, properties of superposition and entanglement and all that. So we're actually able to get a solution time decrease for some of those more complex problems that we've only been able to estimate before. Another thing that can be used for is cryptography. Basically, quantum computing is the destroyer and, I guess, rebirth of cryptography. It destroys the current cryptography in the sense that we rely on telling everyone what the algorithm is for how to have a secure channel, but then we protect our key that we're exchanging between two people. This key is usually 128 bits or 256 bits. Now, obviously, it would take forever to run through and try to guess the number, but with a quantum computer, you can guess that very fast, even if it's 256, it just twice the speed. So quantum computers can basically hack into any of our secure network channels, like between PayPal accounts, whatever. But it can also be used as a new form of data communication. You can use entangled bits and apply, I guess, operators on them and send those bits to other people to send 4-bit information. And then finally, quantum computers can be considered a universal computing device, and it is important to use them to actually simulate the Big Bang, or maybe anything femtoseconds afterwards. You can use quantum computers to do that. So actually, that's it. Here's my sources.
Okay, thank you very much. Question?
Yeah. Okay. How do we know how long to wait before testing the qubit? Like you said, we want to do it quickly so that we don't get some sort of cosmic radiation disrupting it, but we can't do it too quickly because we can't interrupt it. How do we know how long to wait?
For this formula, you literally just have to, I believe the guy that was talking about this, David Deutsch, he's a famous, well, I didn't mention him before, he's a famous, I guess, quantum computationalist, or rather, he wrote some pretty important papers on it. All you have to do is take this angle and figure out how many it will take to get to a 90 degree, and you can actually figure out how many iterations you need to find your final answer for this formula. For other formulas or algorithms, some of them actually rely on you making measurements during the algorithm and then letting the collapsing waves do something special for you. I mean, really, like, all I can say is it depends on the math you're dealing with and what type of algorithm you have. I didn't go into, like, all the eigenvalues and linear algebra, but...
Would this fall to the hardware guys or to the programmers?
It would fall to the mathematician. Falls to the mathematician first to figure out how you want to do it. Then it falls to the hardware guy to figure out how to even represent an operator that can do whatever you need it to do. And then you just have to hope you have a good enough state where there isn't too much, like, entropy, or you don't have to worry about quantum decoherence. Most quantum computers, you actually have to, like, get to near absolute zero, like a couple thousandths of degree above at most. So that's one of their issues I have.
I kind of have two questions.
Yeah.
You talking about the decoherence, which is the destruction of the qubit, right?
Collapsing of the wave. So basically, you're just left with one value. What, from my reading or my understanding of it, is once you make a measurement of it, you'll always get the same measurement of that particle, that qubit. So if you, let's say there's quantum decoherence, it gets set to, let's say, somehow 1. Then every time you measure it afterwards, it's always going to be 1 until you set it or reset the bit again. That's my understanding of it. So, but anyways, your second question?
You said that they have 8-bit computers, right?
Yeah.
What's the highest they have right now, and then what's the highest that they're eventually trying to move to?
As soon as I saw I had like 6 minutes left, I was like, okay, we're skipping most of the stuff. One of them is the neutral atoms in the C-NOT gate. They've actually been able to make a small quantum gate using neutral atoms as opposed to ions. They're working on upscaling it to about 50 bits. There's also a new type of ion trap that's pictured over there on the right using lead ions, some certain way of capturing them, and they're actually able to get a lot of them together. They're trying to bring it up to, I believe, 100 bits, and to just see how, or 100 qubits, to see how feasible it is. In one of the articles I read, it said the largest ion count was at about 8 bits or qubits. So there, you can still do some very basic problems with 8 qubits, but if you want to have a program running that has compatible, like, super condensed code or whatever else, like, that would make a quantum computer, you know, that's desirable, you're going to need somewhere in the hundreds of bits, or certainly more than 60.
How expensive are these to make?
That I didn't look into, but I can tell you that there is no one way to make a quantum computer, and the fact that they have developed some microchip ion traps that are kind of like in microchip form, so I guess it's really more of a experimental research thing. It's not so much like you can order parts. I mean, maybe you could do it yourself, like, but you have to deal with a bunch of like, it's freezing all dimes. I mean, I think it costs considerable money for any businessman to invest in it, you know, right now.
Yeah.
But, so could you generate like truly random numbers,
yes.
Like for keys, etc.
Yeah, exactly. You could do that. What else? One of the things, like the quantum computer, which I didn't get to kind of get across, it can actually emulate any gate that it has on a regular machine. However, the fact that it does have probability always involved, there are actually some problems that it makes no sense to use a quantum computer for. Like, don't expect quantum computers like 100 years from now to somehow replace regular computers, because regular computers do the job well that they're doing right now. It's just that there are certain problems or whatever that can only be solved with probability rather than determinism.
So, kind of like bit laws and stuff. Like,
wait, what I mean?
Like bit laws? Like,
oh,
like it's really like bad to lose a bit.
Yeah.
So if you do that with a quantum computer.
Yes.
If you do like a normal like algorithm that you do now, you lose a bit.
Yeah, that's like bad.
Would you trust a quantum computer to balance your checkbook?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
50%
of
the time, yes.
What I would say, which you
not in this universe.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know what's interesting? That Deutsch guy, he mentioned his algorithm. Rather, I watched the lecture for this. The David Deutsch guy talked about, you know, how to solve this, and he's talking about this algorithm. He basically said in there that you can actually. The error is 1 over to the n, and he said, oh, that's just 1 over to the number of possible universes that exist. So out of these, this many will actually not have it. Like, okay, so you're telling me that one universe gets screwed over, gets the wrong answer?
I hope you don't live in it.
Yeah.
I believe David Deutsch is one of the proponents of the many worlds interpretation.
Yeah, I've seen and I would assume like how he said before. That like so
casually. He's a modern name associated with it, actually. Any more questions?
Yeah. Would you then say that quantum computers would not really give way to concurrency? Because I don't see how like multi-threading or multiple processing would be feasible with
Multi-processing, I think it depends on how you use the quantum bits. I think it could be possible to do quantum processing because you can actually do a couple. As long as you don't, I don't know. I would like to say that I haven't done enough research on like the multi-threading aspect, but there is something like this method of just kind of doing all this checking of just one iteration of operations. I think it might be possible, but only in very like extreme cases where it's like really defined, you know. I don't think it's how we would like to think of it.
I guess you could say, though, that it wouldn't be necessary on a quantum computer.
Yeah, yeah.
So these aren't looking to replace computers we have. They're just trying to add on to the problems we can solve with regular
exactly. computers. Exactly. It's basically that and...
Or make worse the problems we have than the ones we already have. Yeah. Like cryptography.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, cryptography and any problems. There are a lot of, like, a bin packing problem, which is, like, trying to figure out the least amount of buckets to... using like certain amount of, given a certain amount of materials, how many buckets can you minimize to fit in? There's just a bunch of problems that you can do it, and if you can solve some of these like mathematically, you get $1 million. If you can just like prove that polynomial problems are not equal to non-deterministic polynomial problems, gets you $1 million. Like. Just prove it.
That sounds easy.
Yeah, it is. Of course.
Yeah, exactly. Summer break. All right. Let's thank Vladimir one more time. And applause to everybody else who talked today as well.
The cat was like.